Hi, everybody. I'm Andre Alcoholic. And for a moment there, I was wondering who he was talking about. You know, I'd just like to say I'm sober tonight by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and by following a few suggestions. My home group is the How It Works group, sobriety date of 6/21/93. You know, and I'm here tonight because I'm not all here, you know. And for me, you know, my story is not much different than anybody else's in this room. You know, I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous under duress and through a military treatment facility. You know, I wasn't smart enough to know that I was killing myself softly. You know, I had to help people to tell me this, you know, social workers, as they call them in the military. You know, after I had gotten my second DUI, you know, normally what they would do is they would give you a 10 question test. Actually, it was 10 questions, but actually the test consisted of 100 questions. They would ask each question 10 different ways, trying to trick you, you know. But this time they said, well, you know what, we're not even going to give you this test. They immediately diagnosed me as alcohol dependent. The military will not diagnose you as alcoholic because they have to pay you disability, see. So they diagnosed me as alcohol dependent. And they immediately sent me over to the hospital to see a psychologist, you know. At the time, I was suffering from depression. I had just probably about 9 months prior to that, I was a victim of Hurricane Andrew in South Florida, and I had to drive across country with everything that I could muster that was salvageable, you know, in a U-Haul van, 4 kids ODing on sugar, you know. And I know every single McDonald's between South Florida, Miami, and in Las Vegas, because I had a 2-year-old daughter at the time. And she very distinctly pointed each and every one of them out to me, you know. Daddy, McDonald's, you know. You know, on my trip, I guess this is when I really, really started to fall into my alcohol ploy. But during my trip out here, I made it a point to stop every night at a hotel or motel that was close to a liquor store so I could, you know, go in there and get me some beer and some hard liquor so I could pass out that night. You know, I had quit sleeping probably 10, 12 years before that. And what I would do is I would black out. That was a story. So I went on. I remember we were doing pretty good for about 2 or 3 days. Third day, we got to Texas, to the Panhandle, Northwest Texas there. I don't know if any of you folks been there, but that's not a place for an alcoholic. You know, but I went into this place, and I looked all around this convenience store. The kids were all happy. They were outside, you know, doing cartwheels because it was after 10 hours on the road, they were tired, ready to go to a hotel room and stuff, you know. And I was in the store. I went to the case. I didn't see no beer. I said, what the hell's going on here? This struck me as being very strange, you know. So I walked up to the guy, and I said, excuse me, sir, you don't have no beer? And the guy looked at me like I was Lucifer himself. Beer? We don't sell no beer in this part of the country. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I went outside to all the kids and the wife, and I said, you know what? Get back in the van. We're not staying here. And they were some pissed off people. So we got back in the van, and we drove over to New Mexico, which is about another 100-something miles, and they weren't happy. But I was at least able to get a sedative for me, which was my alcohol, so I could black out and go to sleep. Now, I got here to Las Vegas. I stayed with a friend for about 2 or 3 days. And it's funny because I had known this guy probably 15, 16 years. And over the course of 15, 16 years, you know, we had went from where we were drinking together where he would sit and psychoanalyze me saying, man, you know what? You drink too much. You need to, you know, not drink so much. You need to maybe do something about your drinking. So he pissed me off, so I had to immediately go and get me my own apartment. You know, the neighbor just got to tell me something like this. Who the hell does he think he is, you know? So I moved into my own apartment, and I took everybody hostage, you know. They talk about closing the curtains, laying on the couch, you know, and I was stuck in that alcoholic quagmire. You know, it was really amazing because I used to go to work every day, And prior to this point, I was really a social butterfly, as I like to call myself. And I used to like to go out to the club after work and party with these people. But, you know, something was different now. And this was before I got my second DUI. You know, I would tell these guys, you know, they would say, hey, let's go over to the club and have a few. I would say, no, I'm going home. And what I would do is I would go home, stop at Lee's Liquor, pick up my jug, go home, and just, you know, stay there. And I remember, you know, it talks about having a moment of clarity in the big book. And I remember my moment of clarity. My kids had been asking me to cook dinner for them. And I had blacked out. I was drinking that good stuff, too. I was drinking E&J brandy. And I woke up, and my little daughter, who was about 2.5 years old, had a bag of Lay's potato chips spread out all over, crumbs everywhere. You know, this was her dinner. One more time, here I am, you know, stuck into me. You know, and that's the disease of alcoholism, stuck into me, you know. So, this went on for a few months. I remember having to take my wife to work at Sam's Town, and every night I used to take her to Sam's Town, I used to be, so lucky I'd make it back home driving up Nellis Boulevard. But one night, it was a Wednesday night, and I remember this so vividly in my mind. It was April 18th, 1993. In fact, that could have been my sobriety date, maybe. But I believe that was the day that I had an intervention from God. Because this night, when I'm driving back from dropping the wife off at Sam's Town, I got a wild inclination, a bright idea. Hey, why don't you go to the NCO club? You know, Wednesday night is party night there, right? Never before, you know, the whole time I was here, 7-8 months, didn't even think about it. But this one night, you know. And up until this point, I had been really killing myself with this alcohol. I mean, really bad. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I was just like I was stuck in quicksand, you know. But the thing is, this one night when I was driving on the base, the cops at the gate stopped me. He said, you took kind of a wide turn there, and we think maybe that you're maybe a little impaired. They like to use proper language here, a little impaired, so we'd like you to take a field sobriety test, in which I, you know, when he opened the door to my van, I almost fell out, you know. So it really was no need for him to do no field sobriety test because getting out the van was my field sobriety test, and I failed that. So they took me down to the cop shop, and when they took me to the cop shop, they put me in front of this camera sitting in this room. And the guys out in dispatch, they kind of monitor you while you're in there, while they call your first sergeant to come and get you, right? And the whole time that I'm in there, I'm laughing and different people coming in for stuff and I'm joking and stuff like that. So they out there, when the first sergeant shows up, they're out there conversing with him for a little while and wondering what the hell is going on. So, you know, I didn't know what was going on. So the first sergeant, he gets me, signs me out, and he's taking me home. And he says, you know what? I said, what's that? He says, them cops think something's wrong with you mentally, man. I said, really? He says, yeah. He says, because usually when people get DUIs, you know, I was a senior NCO at the time, too. I was an E7, Master Sergeant in the Air Force. They're usually very remorseful, you know, full of guilt, shame. And he says that they even said that they have seen some of them cry, you know? But I was in there rejoicing like I had been saved. You know what I mean? Having a good old time, you know? And maybe I knew in the back of my mind that I was going to finally get some help because I couldn't do a damn thing for myself, you know? Too damn prideful, too ignorant, you know? And so that next morning is when they send me over to social actions. This is where they evaluate you. You know, you get people to evaluate you, to tell you, you know, you're an alcohol-dependent person. They don't like to use the terminology alcoholic. And sent me over to see the psychologist. And when I went to see the psychologist, he said, well, oh, you came here from Homestead, Florida. He says, have you ever, or do you have thoughts of killing yourself? You know, he kept asking me. He must have asked me 5 or 6 times, was I suicidal? And I had got totally fed up with this guy, man, you know. I had gotten so fed up with this guy, I looked at him. I said, you know what, Doc? I'm not freaking suicidal. I'm freaking homicidal. And I looked at him. And he started shaking a little bit, you know. I said, I don't want to kill myself. I'd rather kill you. You know. And I was between drinks then, too, so my eyes were still bug-eyed. I was bug-eyed when I got here. When I got here, I was not a vision for you, Lee. You know, you can see the veins in my eyes, you know. And so he says, oh, we got to get you on medication for depression. I said, well, what about my alcoholism? He says, oh, we're not worried about your alcoholism. Yeah, we need to worry about your depression because you might kill yourself. I said, I'm not going to kill myself. So he sent me across the hall to a psychiatrist to get some kind of medication for depression. And so I go see the psychiatrist, and, you know, he's already ready. He got one, two, or three medicines to lay out for you. Boom, boom, boom. So he's writing this prescription up, and I said, well, Doc, can I drink alcohol with that medication? And he looks at me like I'm crazy. He says, heavens no. You can't drink no alcohol with this medication. I said, well, don't prescribe it. I have been diagnosed as alcohol dependent. And I remember telling him that. And he says, well, I'm gonna have to get you on some kind of medication that alcohol won't have an effect, you know. He said, come back tomorrow. So I guess he did a little research and maybe talked to a couple of his colleagues somewhere. So the next day when I went back, he prescribed a wonder drug of the 90s for me, Prozac. That's the wonder drug, man. They prescribe Prozac for everything from antidepressant to premature ejaculation to everything else, you know. But the truth of the matter is, they put me on this Prozac, and when they put me on this Prozac, all it enabled me to do was to drink more. You know, I went from drinking probably a 1.75 liter bottle every night, blacking out. I mean, not a 1.5, to about a liter to about a 1.75 liter before I would black out. It just enabled me to drink more. And it got so bad, you know, my biggest fear, believe it or not, at that time was sneezing. And the reason sneezing was my biggest fear is because when I sneezed, it came out of both ends. You know, I had no control of my faculties. You know what I mean? And I walked around like this, you know. And you know, when I went to do my thing, you know, it seemed like my body was deteriorating. You know, pieces of organ and stuff would come out when I would excavate, you know. And it was not good. So I went to these folks after about, this is April, about June. Yeah, I guess Father's Day, 2 months later, I went to them and said, you know what? I need to get some kind of alcohol treatment, man. Because I was really afraid. And they says, okay, well, we'll send you up here to Travis Air Force Base to this rehab center. And when I got up there, they put me on a mental ward for 3 days. I don't know about you folks, if you haven't been on the mental ward, it's a great experience, you know what I mean? And I had a friend in the program that told me, he says, if you know, when I went into this mental ward, you see all kinds of folks in there, females and males laying on each other, hugging and lovey-dovey and stuff like this. And I said, what's wrong with these folks? You know, they were serious too, right? But I had a friend in the program that had since told me, he says, if you go into a mental ward and you see two people having a relationship, he said, leave them alone. Because if you don't, they're going to mess up two other people, you know. But after about 2 days, I had these people in there laughing. These folks are depressed and all kinds of other problems. But I had them in there laughing and stuff. And so the staff got concerned, you know. That got concerned. They were too happy. So they opened up the alcohol ward. The alcohol ward was supposed to open up on Monday. We got there on Thursday. They opened up the ward on Sunday and said, you know, let him go up there. So we got up there and we got into our little groups and seminars up in the rehab place, and they put me in this little group with this nurse. She wasn't an alcoholic, but she knew all about alcoholism, you know, through school, through books, you know. And when I got there, they gave me a big book. They gave me a 24-hour-a-day Hazelton, not a daily reflection, but the Hazelton 24 hours a day, and they gave me a little spiral notebook. The spiral notebook was the journal. Every day you had to journal, you know. And they required you to do physical fitness. And all of which, you know, I had been out of the swing of life for so many years when they wanted me to do this stuff. So I had no problem with the big book. I read that probably in about 4.5 hours. Threw it on the desk and said, okay, I read that. What's next? You know, the guy looked at me like, I read it like it was a Stephen King novel. You know what I mean? It's like, wow, you know, never knowing, you know, I'm supposed to be looking at myself here, you know, but that wasn't the case. And the journal, before we went out every morning for our mile and a half run, we had to put the journal on the front counter. And every time I came back from the hour and a half run, or the hour and a half run or so, they would always say, we need to talk to you in the office. I said, what's going on? He says, you wrote down here something to the effect is I like to put my hands around her neck and choke the living shit out of her. They said, well, who are you talking about here? And I said, nobody. You told me when I got this journal to write what I feel. And that's what I feel, you know? I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Anger. Violent. I just felt that way, not having that alcohol in me, you know? And so they put us in our little groups, and in our little groups they required us to do a autobiography. At the time, I was 41 years old, I remember. And I did my autobiography, came back. I was so happy. The charge nurse, the head of the seminar lady there, I did it on a sheet of loose leaf paper like this. I think I did one side of the sheet and then half of the other, and I gave it to her. And she didn't even read it. She just looked at it. She said, well, how old did you say you were? I said, 41. And she said, you're 41 years old, and this is all you got to write about yourself? And she took that piece of paper, and she shoved it right back in my face and said, you're so full of shit, you're not going to recover. This is the way they talk to us, you know? And they also told us when we got in the seminar that you need to be honest. Honesty, they stressed it. In order for you to recover, you need to be honest, you know? And at the time, I also had over 21 years in the military, which entitled me to a nice pension, you know? And they said, well, if you tell us you did anything that's against the UCMJ, for you folks that don't know what the UCMJ is, the UCMJ is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the law by which they punish you if you violate it, then you can and you will be punished, you know, according to the law. And I said, well, you know, whoa, wait a minute now. Honesty, stupidity, I got too much to lose here. But we did have some guys in the seminar that were so self-righteously honest, you know. Not me. I was not a fool, you know. I was still in the mindset that you don't tell people stuff about you because they can use it against you. And they definitely could. Some of the stuff I would have told them, I wouldn't be in front of you here tonight. You know, if you guys were bringing a panel in Leavenworth, I'd probably be there sitting in the meeting, you know. But that was the case. So she threw this paper back at me and told me I was full of crap and I wasn't going to recover unless I got honest and this and that. So I said, well, goodness gracious, I got a bright idea. I said, what I'll do is I'll write something about my former wife, you know, because I really, really did do her wrong through my alcoholism and drug use and the different places I was at and stuff. So I wrote it and I sat down. It was about 13 or 14 guys in the seminar, you know, and I was reading it. I was looking for that effect. You know that effect? You look at people and they're shaking their head and I see the little tear in their eye. Man, it was really, really bad. But it was all legal. You know, some of the stuff was immoral, but it wasn't illegal. You know, it wasn't going to get me thrown in the slammer. And I looked around and when I was finished, the guys were there, you know, and I said, yeah, I got them. You know, I'm over, you know. And now it's time for evaluation. I call her Nurse Betty, from Nurse Betty. She comes up to me again and points her finger in my face. She says, you know what? You're so full of shit. And you know what? And you know you're suicidal. Not once did I hear this in my whole time, except for that one time when I did that second attempt at this inventory that they wanted us to do for the group seminar, right? And what happened is I was on Prozac when I went into this place, and when I got into the program up there, the head nurse there decided upon herself, and she wasn't any kind of doctor, mental or psychiatrist or psychologist or anything. She decided that I don't need Prozac. All I need is this recovery stuff, right? So my depression really came back. You know, I was really angry, right? And when this nurse got in my face, them defensive mechanisms kicked in, you know? And she, you know, kind of embarrassed me in front of all these people saying I was suicidal. And I looked right in her face and I said, you know what, bitch? I said, excuse my French, y'all. I said, bitch, I'm not suicidal. I'm fucking homicidal. And I stared her down so bad that she ran out the room shaking. You know, what's wrong? What's wrong with this picture? I mean, I was serious, you know. Then went downstairs and got the head of psychiatric services at the hospital there, and he came up and did an intervention in the room next door. And he's like, well, what's going on here? He says, you know, he started talking about my anger and this and that. And then evidently, I brought up the thing about being put on Prozac a few months back because of this depression and this post-traumatic stress syndrome stuff and the hurricane and stuff. And he says, well, you're not taking your medication? I said, well, no, I'm not taking my medication. I had been in this place for about 2.5 weeks now, right? And I said, when I got here, she took my medication and said I didn't need it. He said, who took your medication? And I said, well, Captain so-and-so. She was the head nurse there, right? And he says, you wait right here. He walked out that room, and I don't know what he said to her, but when he came back, I could still feel the heat off of him. He was hot. They immediately put me back on that Prozac, you know? Because she made a decision, wrong, that I didn't need this because I'm going to recover now, you know? But the thing is, I may not have needed it if I was going to recover, but since they had put all of these, consequences to me being honest and stuff like that, I wasn't willing. You know, I really wasn't willing. So I went through this 26, 27-day program. And on the last day of the program, I remember getting my final evaluation by one of the counselors in this program. And he wasn't an alcoholic either. He says, you know what, Andre? He says, you danced through this program, you know. He says, but we have a 1 in 10 success rate, you know, with this program. And he says, you're all 9 of the people that's going to fail because you can't get honest. He says, you can't get honest, and you're probably going to be drunk. He says, I'll give you 2 or 3 days. You're probably going to be drunk. So when I got back here to Las Vegas, I had to go see my commander immediately. They don't waste any time. You know, once they get you rehabilitated, you know, that's what they call it. They rehabilitate you. Now this commander, Colonel, has me standing in front of him, and he orders me to not drink for 1 year and to go to 5 AA meetings a week. I didn't have to get any kind of paperwork, you know, annotated or signed or anything of that nature, but I had to do this. And if I had gotten drunk within that first year and they found out about it, I had grave consequences to face, you know? So I said, goodness gracious, I don't know how I'm going to do this. But luckily, you know, this is a program of miracles, man. I got connected with a guy, Al S., who had been around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I met him, probably about 10 years. But I think he had like 4 years of sobriety, in and out, and stuff like that. But he had been around this program. He knew a lot of people here. And what this did is he took me to meetings. You know, every single day we went to a meeting. Sometimes we went to 4 or 5 meetings. Sometimes I needed to go to meetings for some of the meetings I went to, you know. And I'm serious because I used to go to meetings. When I got back here, I used to go to meetings and hear people share things, and I would shake my head and say, goodness, this has gotten to this. What a bunch of losers. What am I doing here? You know, I don't need this crap, you know. And it really, really, I was afraid because I had quite a bit to lose. And I couldn't see myself staying sober. I really couldn't. You know, I used to go into meetings and stuff and sit in the back. People would call on me, and I would raise my hand and say, my name is Andre, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't have anything to share, I'm new. You know, I did that until I got involved in a How It Works group. I got involved in a How It Works group, and I used to run around with this old guy, Wino Pillhead. And Wino Pillhead, I went to a meeting with him at the Thai Club one time, and I pulled that crap, and he read me the riot act outside. He said, how long you been sober? How long you been sober, kid? I said, probably about 40, 50 days. He says, I don't want to hear that BS about you ain't got nothing to share. He says, there's people in here that's been sober a week or 2 days. He says, you've been sober for 45, 50 days. He says, you have something you can share. You could tell them. You could tell them how you stayed sober 45 or 50 days. And I never looked at it from that perspective. You know what I mean? And so life went on, you know, and I ran around with people. You know, I got involved in the How It Works group. Probably had, like I said, 40, 50, 60 days. And it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me because shortly after becoming a member of this group and going to some meetings and stuff, the people actually reached out to me, and they actually invited me to go somewhere with them. And that right there was a revelation. Wow. It had been 6 or 7 years since people had actually asked me to go somewhere with them, because I was not a social butterfly. You know, I was an abomination, embarrassment, you know? And they asked me to go into this family shelter. We used to go into this place every Tuesday night. It was a group of about 6 or 7 of us. And every week, somebody else would share. And when I was newly sober, I loved speaker meetings. Oh, I loved them to death, because I didn't have to share. I could sit there and listen to somebody's story and try to identify with it, you know? And I remember the guy says, oh, yeah, we got a great speaker tonight. Andre, I said, really? And I'm all excited and stuff. I could hardly wait, you know? I'm rubbing my hands together. I said, well, who is it? He said, you. I said, me? Oh, no. I said, oh, no. He says, yeah. He says, it's your turn in the barrel. I said, well, what am I going to tell this guy? He says, hey, man, you were in the military for 22 years, man. At this time, I had about 22 years in the military. I had been places. I had been to probably 22, 23 countries. Can't remember them. Most of them are blackouts. They lost somewhere up there in the gray matter. But, you know, I got up there and I started sharing to some of these folks, and a lot of them reached out. You know, they started coming up to me. You know, I told them my story. You know, I started drinking on a regular basis when I was about 14 years old. I was out there for about 26 years, you know, and I remember, you know, I was explaining, you know, how this disease had taken me from what I call a pretty decent person to really a messed up person. I wasn't really a bad person, but I was a sick son of a bitch, I'm going to tell you. You know, when I was drinking, I'm that type 4 alcoholic they talk about in the doctor's opinion. You know, perfectly normal in all aspects of my life, you know. I had a lot of decorations. I had achieved a lot of stuff like that. But once you put that alcohol in me, I'd do anything, especially if somebody dared me, you know. And I shared how, you know, my life had went on. And, you know, these people came up afterwards and they kind of reached out. And they said, well, yeah, you know what? I got a brother, man, who has got a problem. You know, I got a husband that's got a problem. And it's always been that way. You know, even when I do service, we did a service fair at the Clark County Government Center for the PIC, Public Information. We had pamphlets and stuff, and people would come up. We did another one at the Meadows Mall. People would come up and would get literature for their brother or their wife or their girlfriend. You know, I'm not judging you, you know, whatever. This is the message, you know. We carry the message, right? Then life goes on, you know. And I remember at 11 months or 12 months, sitting at the anniversary group or at the anniversary meeting at the Howard Works Group. Every month, the last Saturday of the month, we do a candlelight meeting down at St. Luke's on Easton. It's a really spiritual meeting. Sometimes you get a little long-winded, but most of the time, you know, it's a very spiritual meeting. And I remember my first year there, and I'm sitting at the table with all these guys and celebrating various lamps of sobriety, and I'm celebrating 1 year, and all of them are, you know, telling how, you know, they're happy, joyous, and free, and everything is great, and I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling like a piece of shit, literally. I'm feeling, you know, and the reason was I was doing a lot of service at the time, but I wasn't doing any kind of recovery for myself. And as long as I could stay busy doing stuff for other people, I was good. But it comes a time when I had to do something for you, for myself. You know what I mean? And I used to tell people, you know, all the service I did with these people, nobody ever said, hey, you know what? Why don't you come home with me tonight and we'll have a meeting all night? They said, nope. See you. See you tomorrow. And that's when I had my biggest problems, when I had to go home at night and watch this big screen TV, you know? Like they said, more will be revealed. You know, the stuff coming to the surface is like, wow, I got to do something about this stuff. So at 1 year, I had a choice. I got to a threshold. I had a choice. You know, I could have went back to that previous life of drinking and having so much fun, which I wasn't really having. You know, I mean, life was really miserable. It was a burden. So I decided to try something different. Because I could recall during that previous year, man, I've had times where I really and truly felt good. You know, I was explaining to another friend of mine last night how going into treatment facilities and going into institutions and stuff is almost like taking a pill, a spiritual pill. You know, you get that high, man, you feel good, you walk it. And I know how that felt. And I said, you know what? I probably feel better right now than I ever felt in my life. And so I decided to give it a try. So I got a sponsor, went through the steps, was rigorously honest. I mean, there was a lot of stuff there, man. I was leery about sharing. But you know what? I prayed about it. And that's one thing I learned when I first got here from this friend of mine, Al, that I told you about. He told me, he says, you know what you need to? You need to start getting down on your knees in the morning. And if nothing else, ask God to keep you away from the drink for 24 hours or the day. And then at night, get on your knees and thank God for keeping you away from the drink. And I've been doing that since that time. I do it almost religiously. I mean, I can count the times probably on one finger that I don't do it, that I didn't do it. I mean, really. And I think that's what's helped me more than anything, because I know today for myself that I have to get in contact with an alcoholic every single day. I got to talk to somebody. And I got to do some kind of work for God's children, you know, because when I got here, people reached out to me, man. And I tell you what, I hadn't felt this sense of belonging for such a long time until I got here, you know. And I was leery at first. I mean, I really was, because I used to say in the back of my head, what do these people want? You know, I wasn't used to people being like this. I said, what do they want? You know? But I had to stick around here long enough to see what they want. And what they want is they want for me to recover. You know? They want me to get what they got. You know? But for the grace of God, you know, I go to AA meetings to learn. You know, the old timers are there to show us how to live, man. I have so many living problems, or I had so many living problems. I don't have a lot that I could talk about, but I had so many living problems when I got here, you know. By talking to people, sharing, opening up, I get the answers that I need, you know. I have never, ever been to an AA meeting where I brought up a topic or brought up a subject where I needed some help, and after the meeting, everybody left and nobody was there. In fact, sometimes you're pushing people away because you got so many that want to give you help, you know. And it's freely given, right? Some people pay $150 an hour for this. Go see a psychiatrist, and they still don't get the answer. He wants you to answer everything yourself. So what do you think? Well, if I thought, I wouldn't need you, you know. That's why I go to AA meetings, you know. I lay something out, and I get different spins, man. I get people to share their experience, strength, and hope, and that's what I need. I don't need nobody standing over me, pointing the finger at me, telling me, you need to do this, this, this. I don't need that. In fact, even if they were right, I probably would reject them just for the mere fact of them standing over me like this. That's just my alcoholic behavior, you know? But, you know, people say, hey, I did this. You know, back in 2000, and God bless the Howard Works Group, I'm going to tell you, because they saved my butt. They saved my biscuit. In 2000, January 2000, my mother was on a deathbed. And it really affected me strange. I had never had feelings like this before. You know what I mean? You're sober, you know, you're sober and you're experiencing feelings that you never experienced before. You know what I mean? And some people, you know, they don't use the tools of the program. They choose to take the easiest software, pick up a drink. You know, but that wasn't it for me. I had a good foundation in this program, and I knew that I wasn't alone. I learned very early that this was a weed program, man. And if I lay it out there, you know, I'd get some help. And I had people that actually reached out to me that really and truly helped me. I mean, that's why I'm standing here tonight. You know, my mother was on a deathbed. She was dying from lung cancer. Brain cancer went up to her brain. And then my father suddenly dies. And I said, goodness gracious, what a selfish son of a bitch. You know, here I'm grieving for my mother. My father has to die so we can give him some attention. This is how my sick mind was working, right? So I went to New York to his funeral. Whew, what a fiasco. And then 4 weeks and 3 days later, we had to bury my mother. And it was tough. You know, it was probably 4 or 5 months after that I really started to grieve, man. I mean, I would be sitting up places and just start crying, you know. I really miss my mother. I mean, really. Even though she had pissed me off from time to time. And then the year after that, right in the middle, January 15th, I get a call from a friend of mine down in South Florida that my son had got murdered. 26-year-old son. Got shot in the head, drive-by shooting. That's the lifestyle he lived. You know, I tried to talk to him, but, you know, he pushed me away because I was a drunk. You know, when I used to pick him up and we do things, you know, he's like, oh, Dad, you're drunk. You know, he smell booze on me. But, you know, he's smoking his weed, you know. But that's okay. You know, it's like the pot calling the kettle black. You know, it's okay to smoke weed, but, you know, I'm a drunk. But that's the lifestyle he chose, you know. And so I had to go down there. You know, I wasn't in this kid's life at all. You know, I saw him when he was young, and then I got back. He was 13 or 14, and I wasn't there a lot. So his mother was kind of financially strapped, you know. And the undertaker said, well, how are we gonna take care of all this stuff? I said, don't worry about it. He says, I'll take care of everything. And that was my amends to him. I had to take care of that whole funeral, you know. And I'm just glad that I had the means to do that. You know, God provided that for me. I had the means to do that, you know. And I had to make it right. You know, and I come back to the group. I talk to people. You know, it was a lady who had lost 2 sons in the Howard Works group. She used to come down there. She's not a member right now. But she used to come down there. She had lost 2 sons. And she put me in contact with this group online, Compassionate Parents or something off the wall, something like that. And I tell you what, after reading some of the stuff that these guys went through, you know how it is when you go to an AA meeting, everybody brings their little problems and stuff, everybody puts their problems in the middle of the room or the middle of the floor, but when you leave, I'm not taking yours, I'll take mine back gladly, you know? It was the same thing with that. I'm reading stuff. Man, I'm saying, goodness gracious, man, I'm really feeling for these people, man. And, you know, my stuff seems so insignificant compared to theirs. And that's a change in me. Because I don't know about you, but before it used to be all about me, baby. Hey, what about me? You know? But today, through this program, man, you know, the spiritual side of this program, I'm learning, you know, I got to reach out for people, be there for people, because people have been there for me, you know. A couple years ago, I lost a brother. My brother was an addict. Nobody knew. We knew he was on heroin a long time ago. In fact, he had went to jail, got incarcerated for smuggling. You know, he had friends sending him stuff from Southeast Asia. But when we went to clean up the house, he had all this methadone in the house. You know, my sister, She looks at it. She says, what's this? I mean, so much. You know, I had a cousin, and I think she was an addict too, because she said, oh, her eyes lit up like dollar signs. Oh, man. You know, I mean, all this stuff. I said, F that. I started cracking the tops, pointed down the toilet, and she's ready to kill me. What are you doing? You know what you're doing? You know how much that's worth? I said, you know what? Can you swim? I asked her, can you swim? We jump down the toilet and get it. I'm dumping all of it. And I come to find out it was methadone from the VA. They were giving it to him. Nasty stuff. But he died from cirrhosis of the liver, and we had to make a decision. We had to make, and I'm glad it was an informed decision. You know, they were giving this brother of mine units of blood every, sometimes 5 or 6 units of blood a day, and it would come right out because he had cirrhosis of the liver, bled to death. The doctor said, hey, look, you know, we got people that really need this blood. What should we do? And my sister, she didn't want to make a decision. She calls me up, and I told her. I said, hey, you know what? We got to let him go because he's not going to make it. And that was hard. And I think that hit me the hardest out of all of the passings that I had in my family, because I remember standing up at the wake here, and I lost it. I had something to read. I lost it. I had childhood friends fill the room up. You know, we had a lot of friends and stuff back in Brooklyn. And I lost it. And you know what? I didn't feel ashamed. I mean, I had true feelings coming out. And that's just how I felt. And I didn't give a damn how somebody looked at me. I don't care. You know, this is how I felt. Never before. You know, I'm not going to try to play Mr. Tough Guy. Oh, that don't affect me. It did affect me, you know. And like I said, I got back here. I talked about it in the rooms. People told me, you know, this is what we did. This is what we did, you know. Nobody told me, this is what you need to do. They said, this is what we did. This is how I got through it, you know. Got a good friend that tells me all the time, you know, when stuff like that happens, double and triple up on your meetings. And that's what I did. I got so lost in meetings, you know. I was neglecting my family, you know. But I needed to do that. I needed to do that because my family wasn't feeling what I was feeling. And it wouldn't take much for them, you know, to get them back up to speed anyway, you know. That's just the way this program works for me, you know. And I honestly and truly believe that this is a God-given program. I look at myself every day and I shake my head in awe. It's like, goodness gracious, how did I get to this? You know, I'm the luckiest man alive. I consider myself the luckiest man, walking dead, you know. I remember when I was newly sober, I had 6 or 7 years of sobriety, and I used to go on base and see people that I used to drink with, and they would see me and they would actually go the other way. Because I was walking erect. You know, I wasn't that Neanderthal man, dragging my knuckles like I used to, you know. I'm standing erect. I talk to people. I look them in the eyes. You know, they could tell that I'm not BSing them. You know, I'm genuine, you know. I'm not trying to impress anybody. And that's what this program has taught me, you know. And that's what it's all about. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it didn't change my life. It gave me a new life. You know, I am not the man that I was when I walked into these rooms almost 14 years ago. Not by far, you know. And people who knew me then and know me now will tell you, it's a transformation. You know, and there's nothing I did. Like I said, I came in here unwilling, unwanting this thing. And I caught alcoholism, you know, sitting in these rooms. About six, 8 months, I think it was, when I heard it, sitting in the meeting, I heard the pop. You know what the pop is, right? My head getting pulled out of my ass, saying, hey, you know, look, what do you want? You know? Today I'm pretty healthy for the most part, you know? I do what I'm supposed to do. I pay my bills on time, you know? Life is running pretty good as long as I stay out of the way. Let the man upstairs run it, you know? He does a fine job without me, believe me. Do what's in front of me. And I learned that right here in these rooms. And I want to thank you folks for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you tonight. And thank you.